That you're here tonight. Tonight starts small groups, and so that's why there are some people that you don't see. We didn't split between the last 5 hours that I'm aware of. There's about 20 people who attend this service on a regular basis that are involved in small groups. So small groups will last 13 weeks, and then they'll take a couple months off, and then they'll go another 13 weeks. It'll be 26 weeks a year, Lord willing. It might not work. It might fall flat on its face. It's a good idea, though. But in any case, there's about 20 involved. There's about 60 total involved. And about 40 of those who are involved do not attend a Sunday school or Sunday night. And that's really what we're trying to engage, to be quite honest with you. We're trying to get that group engaged in some type of Bible study in the life of the church. And so we just feel that that's crucial in regards to making disciples. And so that's what we're trying to do. I hope you judge us based on, I hope we have a pure motive in what we're doing with the life groups. I didn't tell Ralph to say that, but that's a good idea. one of the things that we're facing as a church culturally, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, we're really facing some storms that are coming at us that the full effect of those storms are not yet felt. And a few weeks ago we talked about how essentially when the culture went to a two-income family, Saturday was no longer a day off. It was a day to catch up and to do the housework and to get everything done. Where previous Saturday had been the day off and Sunday was the day of worship, culturally, Saturday became another work day, but only a work day at home. And then you throw in sports on top of that. So now Sunday had to be both the day of worship and the day of rest. And over about a 25-year period, all through America, basically Sunday school and Sunday night, which used to be close to Sunday morning, got cut in half. We just never recovered from that as a church in America. And so where you might have 200 people in church on Sunday morning, you'd have 200 in Sunday school, maybe 170, 180 in Sunday night. Over a generation, if you had 200, Sunday school got cut to 100. Sunday night got cut to 80 to 100. And that transition in the culture just, the church, quite frankly, never found an answer to it. I mean, it happened, and we never did fix that. We had to accept that that's the way things happened, and we never really recovered back to those numbers in the church in America. Again, you have two or three things you're fighting today. One is just the spirit of lukewarmness. The culture has never really been stronger than it is now. It has a way of forcing you into its image in a power, in a way that I don't think existed when I was growing up in the 80s, to be quite frank with you. I was talking to someone, and you know, it used to be that you could keep the culture out of your house as long as you didn't own a TV, because you didn't have internet. You could control what the kids read. You could sort of stop the culture at your front door. Nowadays, you can't even stop the culture at the front door because you got the TV, you got the internet, you got the cell phone. It's just like flooding in your house. And it is creating a lukewarmness. Now, prosperity also creates the lukewarmness. And Americans have never been more prosperous. For the last 30 years, you've had two income families, and they've been having two kids. Previous to that, you had one income family, and they were having four kids. They didn't have the money that families have today. And prosperity tends to create real issues as far as lukewarmness in the lives of individuals. How to stem that tide? There's not easy answers. But another issue, and going back to what Ralph said, is the issue of technology. We have not yet felt the full effect of the technological revolution in America in regards to the church. We've hit the tip of the iceberg, but it is going to change things drastically in the church over the next 10 or 15 years. And one of the things that happens is, if they can listen to it online, they're going to listen to it online. Right now, Sunday morning holds because you have enough moral. People still view Sunday morning as sacred. How long that happens, they tend to view it as more sacred. But for something like Sunday night, the thinking would be among probably the under 40 generation in general, is that, why go when I can listen to it? I can listen to the podcast. And you can, it's even more palpable because you can multitask a sermon. Shopping is going online. In fact, the guy who owns Amazon is now the richest man in the world. Steve Bezos, is that his name? He now got above Buffett and Bill Gates. He's the richest man in the world now. And because he's pioneering online shopping. But even when you shop online, you have to give it your undivided attention. You can't online shop while you're driving. At least I don't think you're supposed to. I mean, it's hard to Amazon and buy stuff on Amazon while you're driving. But you can listen to a sermon while you're driving. It's easier than online shopping. You can't multitask online shopping, but you can multitask listening to a sermon. And again, that's where things are headed. Now, the argument that we use is, listen, you need to be at church. Because you need to be sharing with each other. You need to be provoking each other to good works. You need to be there encouraging each other. You need to be there. But then it undermines that message when people say, well, listen, when I go there, you got 150 people in a sanctuary that seats 700. I'm 40 feet from the nearest person. So I'm not provoking. I'm not fellowshipping. I'm not there. I sit 40 feet from the nearest person next to me. So you see, it sort of undermines the great argument you have for why you should be there. You should be there helping, provoking, conversing. You ought to be there. But again, when you're all spread out, it doesn't have that effect that that's sort of happening. And so again, it's undermining the major argument you have for showing up on a Sunday night. I say that, I'm not telling you to do anything, but I think it would help. I think it would help if, I mean, in general, big needs to be, Sunday morning, large attendance, it needs to have energy. The smaller the attendance gets, it needs to have intimacy. Bigger, you need to have energy. I mean, if you get 400 people together and it's as dead as a doorknob, that's not helpful. But the smaller it gets, the more intimate it has to get. To be smaller and less intimate, that's not a good combination. And actually, Sunday morning is more intimate because at least in Sunday morning, there might be somebody sitting on your row. See, you're closer to people. Getting smaller and less intimate, that's no good. So I just throw that your way. You do with that whatever you want. I do think that it would be better if you could group up a little bit, particularly for visitors who would come into our midst, because Sunday night needs to grow to survive. We need to be winning people to survive. And so we need to think about what visitors feel like when they come here. And I think that it would be better if they were sitting on a pew next to somebody. Anyway, that's my soapbox for tonight. I'm sorry. You're going to cut my pay, aren't you? You're taking $200 this week. I said, we don't pay for no soapboxes. All right. Matthew chapter 6. We're looking at the Lord's Prayer. Begins by saying, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And I want to talk to you about what it means to pray. Give us this day our daily bread. We've been taking up this prayer clause by clause. And the question is, why would you take the Lord's Prayer clause by clause? I think there's two quick answers. One is that if you're not a Christian tonight, if you're just exploring, if you say, I'm not really a believer, understand that the Lord's Prayer is really important because, for instance, one of the things skeptics have been saying about religion for 100 years, really since Sigmund Freud and probably before, is that as people get more educated, as people get more scientific in their thinking, religion will die in the world. And what has happened is that hasn't happened at all. Religion is growing as fast or faster than it has ever had in the history of the world. Science and education is really not killing it when you think of religion growing in the world. And the reason why is that deep down people have a need, they have a desire to connect with God. There's that desire that is within them to seek out that which is bigger than themselves. And so what you have in the Lord's Prayer is the most influential religious leader, the most influential spiritual guide in the history of the world, Jesus Christ, and he's teaching you how to connect with the Father which art in heaven. So that's one reason that you would look at it if you're not a Christian. But another reason is if you are a Christian and you're here tonight, the important things sometimes lose their power because they become mundane. You know them too well and you don't understand how meaningful they are and how special they are. And it's possible to pray the Lord's Prayer and really not think about what you're praying. So every now and then, I think you ought to look at the words, the meaning of the words that we have been taught to pray by our Savior. Now, he says, "Give us this day our daily bread." Now, I want to talk to you about that because it's interesting. If you like words to begin with the letter P, you like all the points to line up with P, really, Jesus has talked to you about the Father's person, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And then he talks about the Father's program, thy kingdom come. And then he talks about the Father's purpose, thy will be done. So he says, this is who the Father is. This is the person. He's got a program. He's got something he's trying to bring about. And that is the kingdom. And is the purpose of the kingdom is to bring about his will in the world. The person, the program, the purpose. That's right. The person, program, and the purpose. I'm confusing myself. Now he talks about the provision, the four P's. All right. He's talking about the provision. So when you talk about our daily bread, the placement, I think, gives you the motivation for praying it. In other words, why should you pray our daily bread? Why should you pray it there? Because, again, I think he's saying the Father has a program. He's got a program, and his purpose includes you, which is to bring his will about in your life and in the world around. And if you think about that, you need to be part of that kingdom. You need to be part of that program. You need to be an agent to bring the will of God out in the world. And so, having said that, pray our daily bread. See, if you think about it, if a soldier is sent, he shouldn't have to feed himself. The one who sends him to the program, the one who sends him to the cause, feeds him, clothes him, takes care of him. If you're an employee, and now you're in this business, you're in this program, and you're part of the sales team, and you're part of the corporate structure to sell these goods, you're part of their goal in life, you're part of their goal, they ought to give you a uniform. They ought to pay you. They ought to reinforce you. They ought to take care of you. If you join their program, then you have every right to expect they are going to provide for you as you carry out their purpose. So as you pray your kingdom, I want your kingdom to come. I want your kingdom to grow throughout this land. I want your will to be done. And I want to be a part of that. You have every reason to expect that God will reinforce you, that he will supply your needs as you're seeking to accomplish his purpose and his program. Another way of saying that is that we ought to pray in his will. As we are operating in his will, as we're wanting to see his will done, as we're wanting to see his purpose fulfilled, we can pray in confidence because, listen, again, an general will reinforce, he'll supply the needs of his soldier. As the soldier is fighting, a good employee will supply the needs of his employer. And God is saying, if you're fighting in my army, if you're working in my vineyard, I will supply your needs. Pray, give us our daily bread, and I will supply that need. Now, you got to be part of the program and the purpose. I mean, many of you here are parents or now your grandparents, but there's a huge difference, isn't there? If you really want something to happen in the life of your kid, and maybe since that kid was a young boy, you've been saying, now this is what you ought to do with your life, and I think you ought to follow this path in your life, and I think this is important. And to follow that path, you'll probably need to go get a college degree. But you need to do this. Imagine the difference if that kid comes to you and says, "Hey, you know what? I need $20,000." Assuming you have $20,000, my kid would be out of luck at this point. $20,000. Imagine they say, "I need $20,000," and you say, "Well, what do you need the $20,000 for?" And they say, "You know that thing you've been wanting me to do my whole life, and you've been saying you need to grow up and you need to do this with your life? Well, I'm ready to do it, and I'm ready to go to college and do that, and I know you want me to do this, and now I want to do that, but I need $20,000 to do that." If you're a parent and you have the money, they might get the money because they're operating in your will. You've been telling them you want them to do that, and now they want to do it, but they need the $20,000. But imagine they come to you and say, "You know what? I need $20,000. You say, "What do you need money for?" They say, "Because I like this girl, and she'd be really impressed if I, you know, drove a nice sports car, and so I need $20,000 to buy a nice sports car." I mean, they're not getting the $20,000. To get it, that's not in your will. I mean, if they would take the time to figure out what you want for their life and then ask you to help them fulfill your will for their life, they got a far better chance of getting money out of your pocket. But you're not going to give them $20,000 to fulfill their will for their life. Not unless you're crazy. You're not going to reward that kind of behavior. And again, as we pray, "Give us our daily bread," we're praying that after we say, "Thy kingdom come, and I want to be a part of that. Thy will be done, and I want to do your will. So give me your daily bread so that I can do your will, so that I can help your kingdom come." I think that's the motive for praying it. But now look at the measure. Let's parse that for a second. He says, "Pray, give us our daily bread." Now, bread was the commodity in the Near East. I mean, bread was the basis of eating that day. I mean, if he had been in Rome, he might have said, "Give us our daily pasta." If he had been in Ireland, he might have said, "Give us our daily potato." I don't know. But bread was the Near East, okay? And so it could have been anything. But he says, "Pray, give us our daily bread." Now notice the size and the scope. He doesn't say, "Give us today our daily cake." "Give us today our daily feast." Doesn't even say, "Give us today our daily Starbucks coffee." Says that. He says, "Give us our bread. Give me my bread." I'm not asking for jewels. I'm not asking for luxuries. I'm not asking you for that. Don't start down that road. Look at the Father who knows your needs before you ask and say, "Lord, give me what I need to live today." Remember how the Bible will constantly say, if you've got food and raiment, you've got food and clothing, not even shelter, but that's a different culture where it didn't get particularly cold in the winter. But he says, be simple in what you ask for. I think that's one of the points. Ask for the bread. And then notice the size. He doesn't say, "Lord, fill my house with enough bread for the next 10 years. doesn't say stuff like that. In fact, you remember the guy, right? Who was the wisest man that Jesus talked about, right? Because he said, look, I've got barns and I can live forever. You know what? I'm going to tear down my barns and build bigger barns. I want to be set for life. And what did Jesus say? Look how wise this guy. This guy has saved. He is set for life. No, that's not what Jesus said. He said, this guy's, you're a fool. You could die tomorrow. Share your goods. And so if God is saying, I'm not going to help you store up stuff for 30 years. Help people with what you have. Then why would you pray, Lord, fill my storehouses? But Jesus says, pray for your bread and pray for your bread today. Say, Lord, I have needs today. I'm not even looking to Monday. I got needs for today. I am trusting you to meet the needs right now. And I'm depending on you in this moment to meet my needs. Now, why would he say, watch the size, watch the scope? And I can think of a lot of reasons. I'm a preacher, so it'll be three, right? I think one of the reasons that he would say, watch the size, watch the scope, is because we have a problem with issues of permanency. And Jesus seemed to be reinforcing repetitively in his teaching that you need to think of yourself as passing through. You need to have that mentality. You are passing through. This is not your home. And he would tell his disciples and those who wanted to come to him, I don't have a house. I don't have a place to call home. I'm passing through. And then in the Bible, you have words referencing us as we're pilgrims, we're strangers, we're ambassadors, life is short, don't unpack. Now, we want permanency, and that's a whole nother sermon. We crave the permanency, but Jesus is trying to reinforce, and those anointed writers under the anointing of the Holy Spirit are reinforcing, you are passing through. I mean, imagine a group of soldiers, and the colonel knows more about this than I do about motivating guys, but imagine you're sending this team out, and you're sending them out for 2 weeks, so you give them 2 weeks of supplies, and they're going out, and they're going to accomplish some task, some military task, and they're gone, and then you get communication, and they communicate and say, hey, could you send us a truckload of wood and maybe some hammers and nails? What would you be thinking? It's like, why would you need wood and hammers and nails? I sent you out there for 2 weeks. It's a two-week job. I'm not sending you out there. And of course, maybe you find out that they decided they really liked it and they're going to build a bunch of houses. It's like, no, that's not what I sent you for. I sent you there for 2 weeks to do a job and you're supposed to come back. You're not supposed to settle there and get comfortable. And I think God is trying to keep us from settling in this world and getting comfortable. There's a sense in which we want to settle down. We want to fill our storehouses. We want to know in our hearts that if we live for the next 50 years, the interest rate is good, we'll never have to work again. We like that feeling. We want to make this world feel like our permanent home, but that's not in our spiritual best interest. Really isn't in our spiritual interest. We're passing. We're pilgrims. We're strangers. And to the degree that we lose that, we start to lose, in many ways, our effectiveness as a church, as Christians. And he says, pray for your daily bread. Remember what James says? He said, today's got enough trouble. Why are you thinking about tomorrow? Don't think about tomorrow. Now, he's not saying don't plan, but he's saying you need to be focused on what God is about today in the moment. And I think that's one reason. I think another reason why he would say, hey, what's your size? What's your focus? Your daily bread. Is that to give us too much, it works against his goal for our life, which is spiritual maturity. I mean, listen, everybody knows. If you're a parent, you can't give them too much. Can you? I don't know, because you got sayings like, you know, they know the price of everything and the value of nothing. They're spoiled, rotten. I mean, we all know that you can't, if you overindulge your kids, that hinders their maturity, doesn't it? This hinders their growth. And if God is about seeing us spiritually mature, I mean, and I think He's probably like parents. You want to spoil them rotten. I mean, you wish you had enough money to give them everything because you love to see the little smile on their face. It just makes your heart warm. But you know, if you did that, you would destroy all the good stuff in them. You would spoil them so much that you would really have to pity the guy that's about to marry them as you walk them down the aisle. It's like, oh man, this girl is never going to be satisfied. I mean, she is rotten. I've given her everything. But, you know, it's been fun. Here she goes. You know that. You cannot give your kids everything. And in fact, you know, I read an article a while back, and the guy was writing about how over the last 20 or 30 years, basically what parents are told by the so-called experts is, you need to be affirming your children and supporting them, and their natural tendencies, you need to encourage those and help them shape what naturally comes to them. And he said, you know, really to be a good parent, you really have to be an adversary of your kids, because the natural tendencies tend not to be helpful for them in developing successfully. He said, for instance, he said, there are three natural tendencies that we tend to fall into. He said, temperamentally, he said, one is anxiousness. He said, an anxious temperament is a temperament that tends to worry and tends to stress. And when a problem presents itself, they tend to get flustered, and they say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't know. I got to think about this. I got to try to make a good decision. And they're sort of anxious in temperament. He said, but then you have the aggressive in temperament. And when they're faced with a problem in life, it's like, I'm going to get them before they get me. I mean, there's a problem, and it's like, I'm going to get them. I'm going to fix it. And then he says, and I don't know why he would use this word, but he says there's the phlegmatic. The phlegmatic. And he said, their temperament is this. When a problem comes up in their life, they say, well, that's life. It happens. Remember the old Frank Sinatra song? You're riding high in April, shot down in May, but I know I'm going to change that tune. When I'm back on top in June, you know, it's like, nobody knows that song? Yeah. I feel like sometimes I'm the only one who lived through the 60s here. You know? But that's their temperament. Yeah, you're ride high in April, you'll get shot down in May, but you'll be back on top. You know, all's well that ends well. And that's sort of the temperament. It's like, you know, all's well that ends well. And, you know, life's that way. And life gives you lemons, and somehow maybe you make lemonade. But you have those temperaments. You have the anxious, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. You have the aggressive, it's like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to kill everybody. And then you have the phlegmatic, and it's like, well, that's life. You know, you just got to accept it. It comes. And he said, you know, but all three temperaments, he said, and to left to our natural tendency, you'll tend to be heavily one of those temperaments. He said, but all three of those temperaments sometimes are right and sometimes are wrong. Sometimes you need to sit down and sort of be worried and come up with a plan. Sometimes you need to be a little concerned. But sometimes you need to be a little aggressive. You need to get the bull by the horns. Sometimes you're just going to have to accept it and say, that's life. Bad things happen, and you can't always fix things, and we have to accept this thing and get a new perspective on life. But again, he was saying, in regards to kids, you have to be shaping them, because they're going to be one of those, and they really have to be all three depending on the circumstances. You've got to be pushing them. You can't let them do their own thing. You have to be shaping them, or they're going to be awful decision makers. And God, I think, He's a good parent. He's pushing us. See, sometimes people say, well, I love my kids too much, and I don't want to push them. I don't want to I don't want to inflict pain on them. I certainly don't want to discipline them. But sometimes that's a very selfish thing to do. And what you love is their approval and love. And you don't want them to be mad at you because what you love is their love. But you don't love them enough to shape them and to help them be the kind of person that they really need to be. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you can love the way people make you feel, and you love it when your child is happy. I love it when my kid likes me. But the thing is that you have to love the child's well-being. You have to love the child. And sometimes that means behaving in a way where they don't like you at the moment. And God is a perfect parent. And again, it is not in our best interest to be spoiled rotten. Now, He does spoil us, doesn't He? I mean, in one sense, He has spoiled us. He's given His Son to us. He's given us everything we stand in need of to grow spiritually. I mean, He's given us everything. He's given us all the love that we could possibly contain. A million years, the pen writer is, the songwriter is right. If you had 1,000 tongues, I mean, you couldn't even grasp the love that He's given to you. He has indulged us in love and affection and affirmation. But having said that, He has not indulged us in the trinkets of this world, and He doesn't seem to intend to. Thirdly, I think it's against God's desire to keep us in I'm passing through mode. I think it's also, again, against His desire to see us spiritually grow. But thirdly, I think it's against His desire to have intimacy with us, to give us, promise us more, let me say it that way, more than daily bread. You know as well as I do that things get in the way. Jenny and I are thinking about buying the girls. They don't have one yet. But we're thinking about maybe buying them a gaming system because they don't have a gaming system. And we're thinking, well, they're sort of at an age where they might like to play video games at some point, you know. The positive of that is that it would be something that they would enjoy and that they would play together. The negative is that that's less time they'll spend with us. Now, that's not always a negative thing, by the way. It might be a good thing to some degree. But it is less time they would spend with us. So that's sort of the negative positive aspect of that. But it's not arrogance for a parent to say, you know, of all the things my kid needs, they need a relationship with me more than they need anything else. Of all the things you could buy a kid, it's not as important as having your attention. It's not. Of all the places you could take your child, it's not as important as spending time with you. That's going to mean more. That's going to shape them more. That is infinitely more important than anything you could give them for them to have you. And nothing that you can give them will compensate for them not having you. And I think God has to weigh that. And in His divine wisdom, I think that He understands far more than our human minds could understand that the more you give, the more the gift tends to take the place of the giver. And I think you know that, don't you? I mean, I know that. I'm never farther away from God than when I have lots of stuff. And I'm never closer to God than when I feel like I'm losing stuff. It's just the way that it is. And you know, I heard a lecture a while ago, and I'll let you go. I know it's late, but he was talking about why Christianity is dying in America, or seems to be dying. And he said, here's what happens with Christianity. He said, Christianity moves into a culture. And the principles of Christianity, when people start living the Bible, they tend to prosper financially. He said, it just happens. When you start to read the Bible about a work ethic and taking care of your family and teaching your family morality, he said, cultures where people no longer lie and steal and cheat from each other, where people aren't drinking, where people aren't abusing drugs, cultures where Christian morality starts to take over, where people start to have a Christian work ethic, where people start to support the government, where people start to faithfully pay their taxes. He said, cultures where Christianity really takes over and starts to dominate, he said, they begin to grow in wealth. He said, Christianity is great for economies. He said, but the prosperity that comes is bad for Christianity. He said, and that's why, he said, where's the capital of Christianity now? He said, we all know where the capital of Islam is. It's been Mecca for 1,500 years or 1,300 years. He said, we all know. It's never changed. If you want to go to the capital of Islam, it's Mecca. He said, but where's the capital of Christianity? He said, it started in Jerusalem, might have moved to Antioch. Depending on what you think of Catholicism, you could say, well, it went to Rome, but then you could say it went to Germany during the Protestant Reformation, and then it went to England, and then it came to America for 200 years. You could say America was the capital. This is the place that's sending out all the missionaries. This is the light that's shining. He said, But now it's moving off seas, so it's moved several times historically. Now it's going off seas. You could argue it's going to China. As China grows, China may be America, the place. I mean, it may be the central place of Christianity in 50 years, unless America recovers. He said, but why does it move? Well, why does the capital keep moving? He said, because Christianity moves in, the economy almost inevitably prospers, and then the prosperity kills Christianity, and Christianity moves off. And we see that in America, isn't it? Isn't prosperity just killing Christianity? It's prosperity. I mean, the thing the church is battling now is people have enough money to travel 20 weeks a year. It's the prosperity that is killing Christianity. It's killing the spirituality of Christians. It's just not killing the church in many ways, but it's killing the spiritual vitality of the Christian. It is. And so Jesus says, give us this day. Don't pray for mansions. Don't pray for cars. Don't pray for the prosperity that will war against your relationship with the Father. Rather, in faith, pray, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day daily bread. Amen. Will you stand with me?